guitar up.
One,
turn
two,
that guitar
three.
Up.
I'm Red Beard, and today in the studio, we'll look at the best of the Seattle fearsome foursome, Soundgarden.
A little bit more like kind of a dream come true. I have a good attitude toward the fact that I get to do this for a living, believe me, because, you know, I didn't always get to. I look at Superunknown as kind of Soundgarden's first white album, in a sense, where we were sort of kind of all going in separate directions and taking music that we all like separately and our own personal influences that didn't necessarily spill out into the other members and bring these influences back into the band and then make that record. Hi, this is Chris Cornell in the studio for Soundgarden Superunknown.
Few bands in rock history have combined brains and brawn as well as Soundgarden. Through a series of singles and EPs on the now legendary Sub Pop label and SST, crunchy guitarist Kim Thayil, thunderous bass player Ben Shepherd, powerhouse drummer Matt Cameron, and singer-songwriter Chris Cornell managed to get Soundgarden signed to a major label deal from the burgeoning Seattle music scene at the dawn of the 90s. Within 5 years, Soundgarden would release their fourth album, Superunknown, that would be the best-selling music in America, number four in the UK, all the while winning two Grammy Awards for songs, plus nominated for Best Rock Album of the Year in 1995. Rolling Stone magazine ranks Superunknown at number 336 on their top 500 albums of all time, and that album alone has sold more than 5 million copies just in the U.S. But long before the acclaim and the success, even before he would realize that he possessed one of the finest rock voices in a generation, Chris Cornell told me that he was frustrated.
I was running around as an instrumentalist, as a drummer, and joining band after band after band, thinking that if I'm just really great at this, and I put everything I have into it, that some fantastic band like U2, and that was the band that was always in the back of my mind, some band like U2 is going to show up and say, we want you, and I'm going to go off and be in this fantastic band that makes wonderful songs and unbelievably great records, and that's going to be my life. And that wasn't happening, because I couldn't find a band that I liked. I was in a lot of bands where if they were writing original songs, I didn't like the songs, I didn't like the singers ever. If you looked at it on a scale, you know, on a percent scale, if there was usually about 20% of something that I would like of a band to be in it, and that was the best I ever did, you know. So Soundgarden was clearly three guys saying, "We're going to have to make our own band and our own music, huh? It's going to be." And I even thought this will be harder than I thought, because I'm not just going to be able to concentrate on my instrument and be great at that. I actually have to sort of make the music happen, or I may not ever hear it. And that's what started Soundgarden. And so our goal, after, you know, a few months of being a band and writing songs and realizing we were doing it and having the time of our lives, because it was super exciting, our goal became, we have to get some independent record company to put this stuff out. And I don't think that our goal really changed after that. It went, the outside interest started really with people we didn't know in the Seattle area saying, you know, this, you guys, you have something special. And I was still playing drums and singing from behind the drums, and I still was having people say to me, you have an amazing presence on stage and your performances are fantastic, even though you're sitting down the whole time, and things like that. And people saying, just generally being really encouraging and saying, what you guys do could be something that could someday evolve into something really big, you know, and the word big would be used. And then when we put out our first record, people would start writing about it. And even before we put out our first record on Sub Pop, people would write about us outside of Seattle. But, you know, to me, it was always in the context of we are who we are. We're writing a lot of songs. It will be a crime if we don't get to release them and people hear them. And it ended up being 3 years before we actually got to release our first Sub Pop record.
A great lumbering groove with the classic Chris Cornell line, "I'm looking California, but feeling Minnesota." That's Outshined from Soundgarden's 1991 Bad Motor Finger album, their second major label release. Here's singer-songwriter Chris Cornell on his formative years.
I started writing songs really young. My mother bought an upright piano, not like a student model, but like a big sort of what would be like sort of a barroom size piano upright that was brush painted black. She might have even done it. She might have painted it, put it in the basement. And I don't remember why, because I had older siblings, maybe somebody was interested. I don't remember anyone ever playing it. It just appeared one day. And I started writing songs on it without knowing anything about piano, but I was writing songs that I could repeat. They had titles. The sitting in a room with an old lady and with too much old lady cologne, and then having to go home and rehearse and practice and learn and then show them that I did well and get graded on it, all of that. That had nothing to do with music for me. So I quit that. My older brother had an acoustic guitar. I think I learned some chords on that. I wrote songs on that, kind of folky-ish songs. I remember singing them to my parents one time. Another big thing that hit me around that time was the discovering the Beatles, which was, I discovered the whole, yeah, they were pretty good songwriters. I discovered their whole catalog at one time by rescuing it from my neighbor's basement, who was his older brother, who had a lot of records, and he had like all the Beatles records. And he had been kicked out of the house and left stuff at home, and just to sort of sit in this flooded basement and deteriorate. And I just grabbed this stack of records, and it was all, I didn't know when I was grabbing it what it was, but it was all the Beatles. It was all their records, but it was also like compilations and different things, everything that you could want to find. And I had to take them out of the sleeves because the sleeves were all soggy and warped. And I remember I took paper towels and I put each disc between a paper towel and had them all stacked up. I just started listening. That had a big effect on me. Even then, I have to say I didn't think that this is something that I can do, or this is something I gotta do or I wanna do. I almost feel like I was doing it when that dawned on me.
Yeah!
Wow, great intensity, and one of the coolest guitar riffs ever from Soundgarden guitarist Kim Thayil. That's Chris Cornell's Rusty Cage from 1991's Bad Motor Finger album. Here's Chris.
But that Beatles period was probably the most important thing that happened to me, if you want to relate it to songwriting, to lyrically, musically, being able to make records, to produce records, everything about it, the texture of guitar sounds. So I sat for probably a year and a half or 2 years, and what I did for fun, more, you know, I was like a normal kid. I ran around outside with my friends, but I also spent a lot of time alone in a room just listening to these records one after the other, one side of an album at a time, and really absorbing all of it. And I think that to this day, it has a lot to do with how I am as a singer as well, approaching each song as, you know, a palette to sing in the way that the song seems to want, and not think about how I sing as an individual and forcing that song into that framework. That's 100% Beatles, because I didn't know that they were a bunch of guys that sang different songs in the Beatles. I didn't know if it wasn't all the same person. I just thought that's what rock bands do. You take the kind of music you like, you make a song out of it, you sing it in the way that makes sense for the song, and you have fun with it. It's expressive. It's enjoyable. I didn't know any different. And I think I still don't, really, because it's never crossed my mind that there should be such a thing as like an easily identifiable style with the way that I sing or write a song. I think I always felt like that's supposed to sort of happen on its own, by accident. You don't invent it. You don't come up with a way of, okay, this is a sound, and people will always know me for this sound because I figured this out. I think it happens sort of by accident. You express yourself, and through who you are, you create something that people come to recognize.
Up next, Chris Cornell of Soundgarden takes us through their multi-million-seller blockbuster, Super Unknown. For this and your other favorite band interviews, visit inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Soundgarden's Chris Cornell in the studio for Telephantasm, the best of Soundgarden.
Hi, this is Chris Cornell in the studio for Soundgarden's Super Unknown, in the studio with Redbeard.
Thank you, Chris. When it came time for Soundgarden to enter the studio in 1994, the song stash was empty, a daunting creative challenge to main Soundgarden songwriter Chris Cornell. But Chris found it liberating as well.
On our second record, the first full-length album, the SST record, we had a lot of songs already written. So we didn't necessarily need so much time. And I think even up through Bad Motor Finger, there were ideas that were around when we started writing for those records. Super Unknown was a record written entirely from square one scratch. We didn't have any ideas. There were no old songs we were thinking about adapting to the new record. We had zero. Bad Motor Finger was the first record that really sold a lot. Previous to that, we were, you know, 200,000, I think, was Louder Than Love. It was perceived as a much bigger record commercially than it was, because I think culturally it was a big record. But actual sales figures were pretty small. Bad Motor Finger was a big record. And so for a lot of people, that was the first time anyone had heard of us, and yet we had already been a band for quite a while. And I think Bad Motor Finger was this definitive Soundgarden as an experimental, very heavy, hard rock band. We nailed it. I think we defined who we had been trying to be for years with Bad Motor Finger and with Super Unknown. I think a lot of people expected a follow-up as if Bad Motor Finger was our first effort, but we as a band had to reinvent ourselves, right? We had to become a new band, even though we were just really being discovered by most people. And so we really deconstructed, I think, how we had been working up to that point. And I looked at Super Unknown as kind of Soundgarden's first white album, in a sense, where we were sort of kind of all going in separate directions and taking music that we all liked separately and our own personal influences that didn't necessarily spill out into the other members, and bring these influences back into the band and then make that record. It included everyone in the band. And it also I started entertaining the idea that if Ben Shepherd, for example, plays guitar on a demo on a song he wrote and it's great, then maybe he should play it on the record. Why do we need to be confined to roles of bass player, guitar player, drummer, vocalist? Because we don't. We can do anything we want. And I had noticed, being someone that, where I would demo songs at home, there might be some character to this demo that didn't get reproduced by the band when we would make the record, because we just sort of had a way of doing things already. And I was already eager to break down the way we were doing things consistently so that we would make something fresh and new. And that was that record.
Inspired by the real-life Seattle street musician, artist, that's Spoon Man from Soundgarden's 1994 Super Unknown album. Again, Chris Cornell.
The writing process, you know, I went really deep into kind of trying to experiment with how I wrote, trying to shirk some of the fear, I think, that anyone who, when they write songs alone, might have of making mistakes. And then, you know, it's scary for anyone in any band, no matter who they are, to play their other band members a song they wrote and sit down with them and say, here, I wrote this song. And especially if you really like it, it's the more you like it as the writer, I think the scarier it is, because you really might want that song on your record, or you really might believe in it. And music is such an intangible, and tastes in music, it's so hard to really define it. And, I think so for Super Unknown, I wrote some songs that weren't good. And I just had to get through that. I had to have the guts to, like, go through that whole process. And the last song that I wrote for it that I demoed was Black Hole Sun. In my eyes, indisposed, in disguises no one knows, has the face like my youth.
terrific song, easily one of the 90s best, from Soundgarden's 1994 Super Unknown album. Here's the composer, lead singer, Chris Cornell.
And I almost feel like there were months and months where I spent time alone in a basement writing and going through this process of writing songs that I really wasn't in touch with the expressive nature of songwriting and just the honest aspect of it. I was trying to manipulate it too much and failed. But I also kind of found myself more so as a songwriter than ever before doing that. And Black Hole Sun was the last song that was kind of like the baby of that long labor, where the whole idea musically and lyrically just kind of popped into my head when I was driving home from the studio one night. And I think I whistled the melody into a tape recorder so I wouldn't forget it, but I never had to go back and listen to it because I never forgot it. It wasn't constructed. I didn't, I messed around a little bit with the melody and a guitar, but I really didn't, it wasn't something that took more than an hour. And recorded that demo, and I remember listening to it back. It sonically sounded awful. Everything I recorded alone at that time always sounded awful. I wasn't an engineer, but I wanted the personality of the song to come across. But I remember listening back to it and feeling like I had transcended somehow even my own ability to worry about being critical about it. It was like, even if it's just now and I'm listening to it back this one time, it's like, this really is, I really love this. Whatever it is, if it doesn't go on the record, who cares? And if my band doesn't love it, I don't care. I had that moment of just appreciating something that I had done for what I was hearing back, and that was the last thing I remember. They actually heard that song and fell on Black Days. I gave them tapes. I learned that it was easier on me to give them tapes and let them listen to it alone and tell me later than to sit in a room and watch them going through the emotions.
Another great Chris Cornell song, Fell on Black Days, originally appears on Soundgarden's 1994 Super Unknown album, which went on to sell over 5 million copies. Still to come, Chris Cornell returns to sort out myth from fact regarding the Seattle music scene in which Soundgarden was a centerpiece. Plus, he'll share exciting news about the reformed band and play us the first new Soundgarden release in over a decade. For this and more, visit inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Chris Cornell in the studio for Telephantasm, the best of Soundgarden.
Hi, this is Chris Cornell in the studio with Redbeard.
Thanks again, Chris. Soundgarden's massive success with the 1994 Super Unknown album did not happen in a creative vacuum, far from it. With contemporaries Pearl Jam, Nirvana, and Alice in Chains, Soundgarden was at the vortex of a specific geographic creative community, the likes of which America hadn't seen since the New York City CBGB days 15 years earlier. I asked Soundgarden lead singer and songwriter Chris Cornell to help separate the music from the mythology that grew up around them.
I think that the focus was on a handful of groups that had a certain common thread. And if that common thread wasn't there, they weren't focused on. And that was really kind of an aggressive and kind of irreverent approach to rock music that included influences from the 70s, which was not considered cool in punk music or post-punk music or indie music. Any reference to 70s music was kind of bad. And the Seattle bands sort of did that unashamed and were known for it. But there was a much bigger picture, and that included a lot of other bands. And there was a lot of creativity in music and in art and filmmaking that was a part of that scene as well, that was overlooked or was never really discovered. Soundgarden was a part of that. You know, we were considered one of the loud, noisy, kind of heavy bands, and it was supported by the art scene. It was supported by the local college radio station. It was supported by the writers. It was supported by everyone that was in an art scene. It really was almost more of an art scene than a music scene in a way. That's what it was that people didn't get about the Seattle music scene, was that it was creativity, and there were no parameters. There were no limits to it. There were no rules about it. Anything you wanted to do with art or music was part of what that scene was, and that was pretty much overlooked, I think. But it was presented to me often as if we had like a boardroom, and we actually all got together. All these different bands might sit at a table and discuss exactly what we're going to do as the Seattle Movement, which it was called, like the Seattle Movement. Like we had maybe sat and had a man, and we wrote up a manifesto together, all the bands, and decided to make a movement to go conquer the music business.
Sun is mine, sun is mine.
Soundgarden included the Chris Cornell song Burden in My Hand on their 1996 album Down on the Upside, frankly calling out the reckless drinking and drugging that he saw among his peers. Cornell admits that he wasn't immune to the dangers either.
One of the best things, for example, that's happened to me in the last probably 6 years or 5 years or so of my life and my career was just suddenly living a healthier lifestyle physically and mentally and like kicking out alcohol and all of the behavior that goes along with that. Suddenly I had the energy to do all the things that I wanted to do. And this is one of those things, to get out and do acoustic shows and to talk about my music and to see people and do it on, you know, on a level, a show where 1,000 people come, where it's hardcore fans, people that I know, you know, they have all the records I've ever made. And I'm coming out and doing new songs for them before the record comes out. That's something I've always wanted, to be able to do it. I've always had the ideas to do it. Didn't always have the energy to do it or the ability to do it or the time because, you know, my lifestyle just didn't allow for it. Because I would come into my studio in the morning to work on a song, and I'd sit around for like 2.5 hours, 3 hours drinking coffee and battling a hangover. You know, it's just, that's as simple as that. Dumb stuff that I had no business getting into that, and I had no business allowing that to actually become an obstacle in getting my music across. Just like anybody else I that has had those issues, and I had to deal with it just like anybody else. And I was just as susceptible to overdoing it or to excess as anyone. In an environment when you're a rock singer, a guy in a rock band, no one's going to fire you if you show up for your job drunk. So I was one of the more together guys out of Seattle that was running around the world and making music for a really long time, but for me, you know, God, it sort of was laying in wait for a rough period in my life personally, and I just fell into relying on drinking to just kind of pacify me, and I was ignoring my life problems. It's sort of a cowardly way to deal with things, and honestly, it was just probably the same way that other people decide to wrestle with it. I just got tired of it. Woke up one day and thought, I have absolutely no patience for the way that I am now. And there's no reason why I have to be living like this, and that my personal life should suffer, or my, you know, or I should even have relationships or a personal life that shouldn't exist, and my music suffering and the gifts that I've been given not being utilized to their fullest ability. I was always trying to push the envelope, not just try to keep up. I have a good attitude toward the fact that I get to do this for a living, believe me, because, you know, I didn't always get to. And it's that aspect, you know, I don't ever want to be, I'm going to have regrets. Everyone has regrets when they look back on their life. But I want to make sure that the one I don't have is that I took it for granted that I was able to write and record and perform music for a living. We'll be right back.
I'm Redbeard. We'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guest Chris Cornell. For interviews and exclusive live performances by the biggest names in rock, visit inthestudio.net. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Barbarossa Limited Productions, copyright 2010, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunat. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Be a part of the In the Studio Network at inthestudio.net.